Good evening, everybody. James McKenney here with my Science Hour. This show is September 1st, 2022, in the ongoing year-long series of the history of discovery of my work. And I'm talking now about the books that were released in the early 2000s. So that was the Planet X, Comets and Earth Changes, the Surviving Planet X Passage, Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn Connection, the Weather Book, the Principia Meteorologiae, the Physics of Sun-Earth Weather, the Diamond Principle, and then also Calculate Primes. And so I left Calculate Primes out a little bit because it's a math book, but it actually was a building block, a very essential building block for the Diamond Principle. And so last week I ended by talking about going into space with large spacecraft in low Earth orbit so we could learn how to just do basic things in outer space in groups. Maybe have sports competitions in outer space. Maybe you could have a tennis court, and you could have a space station with artificial gravity. So you could have swimming pools, you could have courts, tennis courts, and small, you know, because today they play soccer, for example, on a very small, limited scale court. And it's got fences around it, and so the ball doesn't, and they have these all lined up, and you go to a facility, And it's a way for people to get exercise, is the point. So people living in space don't have to be these people floating around in gravitationalists, the view that we have been given by this more than ridiculous space agency called NASA. No, a space station is big and spacious where you have room to move around. And in the Diamond Principle, I describe such a construct. That would be these large tubes. They could be as much as, say, a football field long and maybe 50 feet in diameter. So these are long tubes and they're bundled together, and I talk about this. If you look on my webpage, jmccsci.com, I give a discussion about these spacefaring space stations, etc. Now, I'll tell you, when I taught astronomy at the university level, I required the students to have a project. Everybody had to have a project to complete their semester and get a grade. And I said, now, I want this to be really open. So you can, and it had to be related to space, astronomy, you know, science, etc. But I gave them a lot of leeway. So one guy comes in, he goes, hey, by the way, I work at, the big airline... Northwest Airline was the big company in Minneapolis. I was in Minneapolis, Minnesota at the time, and it was the winter time. And he said, by the way, I am a mechanic on 747 jets, and I can bring the class out. We're stripping down a 747 for the 10 million mile checkup or whatever it is, and they literally take the skin off the aircraft. They take everything out. They gut the entire airplane, all of the seats, everything. They got this entire aircraft. So when you walk into an airplane, you just, you know, you see the seats, you see the inner fairings, and you see the all of the visual structure that you see in an airplane. But I don't know how many people have actually seen an airplane just completely stripped out, none of that in there, none of the seats. And then the skin is completely off, so you see all of this hydraulics and electronic tubing. It's amazing. It's actually beyond amazing. And a 747 is a big, big airplane. And so I got a little nervous getting up on, we walked up on this step scaffolding going up in, and I was just a little nervous. I mean, you are way up in the air when you're walking into the side door of that 747, and it's the little teeny door compared to the whole aircraft. And so you walk inside, and here is a 747 completely gutted out. And, I mean, that made me understand that, yes, we can build structures that are this big. I mean, you could put an apartment complex inside one of these things. They're huge. Absolutely enormous. And these things get up in the air and fly across the country at 35,000 miles an hour, you know, at 40,000 feet. These are amazing structures. And so anyway, I designed the space station concept after the idea, and then also the launch concept. And you can see that on my webpage. Just scroll down. It's called the JMCC Space Hotel Launch System. And then you can see all the other pictures related to that, etc. But the idea is it's not this huge complicated thing. When you see, for example, the von Braun space station that was drawn back in the 50s during the Disney, back in the Disney days, they were showing the moon launch and what it would be like. And they used Werner von Braun, who was, of course, the German scientist, Operation Paperclip, brought to the United States to help run the United States space program. But the thing that they showed there, very complicated, where there's all kinds of big, odd-shaped pieces, on and on and on. Or if you look at the Stanley Kubrick movie, 2001, and look at the space station there, and it just like, oh yeah, they're just putting all these pieces together. But the question is, how do you get these big, odd-shaped pieces up into space? It's really a complex project. And so what I did is I said, well, no, we'll just make everything out of big tubes. And we'll hook it like a little erector set. And, you know, everything will be modularized, etc., and repeatable. And it's a very interesting concept. And then I designed the propulsion system that would spirit this spacecraft off away from low Earth orbit out into general outer space and potentially orbit the sun and then have literally hundreds of thousands of people on this. But the idea is that the propulsion systems that would launch these could literally be electric. And there might be some fuel involved, but primarily electromagnetic. And then the other thing is that when these tubes go into orbit, they're already going to be structured with, if they're going to have pools or other things, but all made out of lightweight composites. The other thing is that once this propulsion system that would spirit this big space station away from Earth would be using local electrical batteries and a magnetic propulsion system, which I've designed. It's specifically for this big rotating gravity field space station. So you have artificial gravity. And then also an issue with radiation. How do you protect these people from the radiation issues or from colliding meteorites? Now, just recently they said that the James Webb Telescope, which was launched and put into space just a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago here, got hit by a micrometeorite. Well, how do you protect a spacecraft from micrometeorites? And it's already, the technology is already there. It's a very interesting technology, and it already exists. In fact, it exists in, for example, bulletproof glass that will stop a bullet. Well, you'd think a piece of glass would break, but the technology is such that it will take the energy out of the projectile and trap it. So I'm sure the French knights would have loved something like this back in the Middle Ages, when they were being bombarded by English arrows. But back to the idea of the space station and going into outer space. But the biggest thing in going into outer space is the psychological issue. You can't have people going up into a space station that don't understand what it's all about. And the biggest thing is that it does not fit the modern American Western venture capital investment model. Because who's going to invest in a venture that goes off into outer space with 100,000 people and makes no money? Where are you going to spend money on a space station? There is no place. But I'm sure they could find a way to work this into the Western economic model, where you would have to buy your food, you would have to buy all your stuff, but primarily it would all be initial investment, because you would have to be growing food on this space station to feed all these people. So a big portion of the space station has to be dedicated to growing food. That food would also be used to recycle oxygen and carbon dioxide. In other words, People breathe out carbon dioxide. That carbon dioxide goes into a chamber, a big one of the tubes, which is meant for growing, and it's then growing the food. And it turns out, this is interesting, that romaine lettuce is one of the best plants for converting CO2 back into oxygen so humans can breathe it again. But let me just read a quick passage here from the Diamond Principle book, and then I'll move on. I'll talk a little bit about the Calculate Primes book, and that'll get us through this initial period. The Calculate Primes book came out in 2007, so a little bit after the first part of the year, the early part of the 2000s. But let me just read a passage here from the Diamond Principle. And this is from the 22nd chapter. It's called The Diamond Principle, A Summary. And I talk about DNA. I talk about the beginning of the book where I discuss the diamond being found. Is it the only one? And of course it's not. Then I talk about the prime number book, which is essentially the same thing, where you have 0 and 1, and I can create all the prime numbers from just 0 and 1 using the generator function. And so what is the generator function? It's a function that I discovered. I was looking for this on purpose because I knew there had to be a mechanism for generating the prime numbers, and I found it. But then it applies also to things like snowflakes or galaxies or DNA. And here's the issue with DNA. I'll just quick read this. It is clear that when one studies DNA and the nucleotide building blocks with their arrangements of carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, and hydrogen, that these would likewise be the same on the far side of the universe and every place in between. Using the concept of the generator function that builds larger groups of prime numbers out of more primitive groups, one can deduct that nature has a set of universal truths that are as true and correct on the far side of the universe as they are here. Therefore, not only is there DNA-based life on all parts of the universe, but these life forms are similar and share the same basic genetic codes. They are compatible down to the most rudimentary levels, but with the anticipated diversity that is apparent from the life we already witness here on Earth. In other words, the building blocks are the same, but the end result, the biological systems, are very different. Then I say, will there be a burl oak tree on faraway planets? Well, probably not, unless some species brought the seeds to Earth. But will there be trees on faraway planets? And the answer is yes. In other words, they're not going to have the oak tree that we have here on Earth, but they're going to have trees. And they're going to be very similar in their very basic nature. And then going down to the last part of this, I talk about galaxies. Oddly enough, we may be able to see the universe much better from our remote location in the far expanses of the galaxy arm and may have a far superior vista of the great beyond. Although for us, going to the next star is over 4 light years away. And so there I'm talking about people who live farther in, or beings, whatever, aliens, whatever you want to call them, living in closer to the center of the galaxy, are going to have a lot of stars around. So they're not going to have this nice, pristine view of the night sky that we do. Their sky is going to be ablaze with stars. And so here's the last paragraph of the Diamond Principle, and I want you to get this, kind of let this sink in. The realizations from the understanding of the prime numbers and DNA to the social realizations of personality and personal responsibility and disallowing the military to precede their efforts are universal. If these groups fail at any of the necessary steps, or if they realize but ignore any of the steps, they will be doomed to failure and will be lost in the dust with the countless others that failed before them. From this perspective, and given all of the roadblocks to success, it would appear that the chance of success is as small as that of a salmon egg making the journey to fully grown salmon. However, we are not like the salmon egg that only depends on factors beyond its control. We are an intelligent species with potential to control our destiny and decide our ultimate fate. My personal opinion is that the human race as it exists today is not capable of making the changes to control its leaders and directing its purpose as required by the universal truths of the Diamond Principle. In other words, man is failing miserably at all of the responses to war, etc., and it's going on today. The human race just is not succeeding. And the idea that there are aliens, this was poo-pooed by Carl Sagan, etc., and that this is just a ridiculous idea. And now there's a big push towards trying to disclose information that the CIA or the Navy or other intelligence agencies have about aliens. But imagine, when we go to another planet, we are aliens by definition. We're not from there. We are aliens. So are there aliens? Yeah, we are aliens. We are aliens when we go to another planet, or if we ever go to another solar system, by definition, we are aliens. So are there aliens? Yes, of course. Are there going to be other ones of different, you know, development? Of course. To think that there are these millions and billions of galaxies out there with just hundreds of millions of stars in them, and to think that we are the only beings in the universe is bizarre. I mean, that's a bizarre thought. Okay, well, enough of that, but the whole idea of putting these books into perspective at this time frame is that these were things that changed the course of people's thinking. These were things that changed the people's perspective on outer space and our ability to go into outer space and what we should even be doing there. Before that, nobody questioned this model of NASA that, oh, we're going to send 3 men to the moon in 20 years. You know, what a ridiculous concept. What's that going to do? Nothing. You know, and it's not going to establish a base there. But the whole idea, remember, is to keep you from going into outer space, because it's really easy. Going into space is not difficult. Okay, so just quickly on the Calculate Primes book. It's a philosophical book besides being a mathematics book, because it took me decades and decades to really crack this nut. It's possibly one of the ones I worked on the most. The understanding of, for example, the Nazca lines, that they are a complex of fractal antennas in an array for transmitting and receiving signals from outer space. That took me a very short amount of time. It was like by accident, almost. I was there. I was visiting Peru as a tourist, doing some other work on the side, some of my science work, etc. But the Nazca lines were not one of my primary objectives. And so when I went there, and then I came back a few days later, it all hit me like a ton of bricks. So it didn't take that long, but the prime number solution to directly calculate prime numbers took me decades. And it finally dawned on me that I had to forget everything I knew about what I had studied, what other people had done. And this problem is the oldest problem in the world. Literally, mathematically, it's a 2,500-year-old problem. It's the Greeks knew about this issue, that if you took rows and columns of things, you took 5 rows and 6 columns, and they would put their military troops, what if one guy was ill or got killed in battle or something, then potentially you could not take what was left over and put it into neat rows and columns. And that was the issue, that there were some numbers that they called them prime numbers. These were the numbers that did not fit neatly into rows and columns. In fact, you could only line them up in one column. And so they didn't, okay, that's fine, that's an observation. But what are all these different numbers, and how many are there? Are there an infinite number of them? The Greeks solved the issue of the fact that there are an infinite number of primes, but there are still some outstanding mathematical problems. For example, are there an infinite number of twin primes, where you have, for example, 11 and 13, they differ by 2, that's a twin prime pair, because they differ by 2, and as far as computers can calculate, there are always more of the twin primes. Well, It turns out with my ability to calculate primes directly, it brings it closer to understanding the solution to that problem. And I'm not going to talk more about that, but the whole issue of solving a math problem, it broke the encryption and firewall algorithms that had been used by the military, by all branches of the military internationally, by satellite companies, by computer companies, by IBM. I worked in a company that built IBM-compatible telecommunications processors, a very complex process. And we used, throughout that process of building, designing these machines, encryption and various types of encryption. Sometimes encryption takes on different forms, but one of the main types of encryption used out in the public is what is known as public key encryption, or prime number encryption, or RSA codes. There's a number of different names for this. And RSA refers to a specific company that developed these, had supercomputers, and used this method of using prime numbers for computer protection, encryption, encrypting data that would be sent on a lines, for example, on the internet, etc. When you log into your bank, it says there's encryption going on there. And just one thing, that you are probably not a big target of this, you and your little bank account, even if it might be a big account to you, you're not the big target. The big target would be stores like big stores that have been hacked, where the hackers can get into the database of these big stores and do some real damage and also make some serious money doing this. And people ask me, well, why would I publish something that does this much damage? And the reason is very simple, that if I solved this and word got out that it was solved, then it would, number one, put me at risk, big time. And number two, somebody else might discover it and not be so nice as I am and keep it a secret and do a lot of damage before that was discovered, that people were able to break into banks and other institutions where people have their money and et cetera. But the thing is that when the book came out, the government, the CIA and the NSA refused to allow companies to build better encryption systems and forced this terrible form of encryption to continue. The reason being is they would have to retool all of their hacking and observing software, and they would not be able to get into everybody's computers. And so this method of using prime numbers for encryption was almost universally used. So their ability to surveil the public would have been severely damaged if they would have admitted that this, in fact, broke the RSA codes. But however, interestingly enough, this is what happened a number of weeks later after the release. This was on March, I believe it was March 7th. I might be wrong about the exact date, but 2007. But Michael Chertoff was the Homeland Security guru at the time, or the head of Homeland Security. And he got up on a podium and he made a very unusual statement. And there was no other statement made at the time. He simply made the following statement. He said, all of our encryption is broken. We don't know how bad it is, and we don't know how to fix it. And so the whole issue was that everybody had been assuming all of this time, for literally decades, that this mathematical problem, which had been proposed by some Harvard University mathematicians, that the use of prime numbers as a basis for encryption could not be broken, and it would take thousands of years with the most powerful supercomputers to break these codes. And I came along and showed how to develop prime numbers. I later came out with a book literally 7 years to the day. It was March 7th in 2014, and it's a book called Breaking RSA Codes for Fun and Profit. And that book laid out the details, how you specifically could break the RSA encryption codes using prime numbers, the public key encryption codes, by finding the prime numbers that were the pairs that were used to create the larger number in the public key encryption method. And so what the mathematicians at Harvard assumed incorrectly was that nobody would ever crack the problem of literally what I call the prime number problem of calculating directly the prime numbers. And also the DVD, the Calculate Prime book comes with a DVD. It's a 3-hour lecture. And what I did is when the book first came out, I gave it to some people who were engineers and mathematicians and very well-trained people. And they came back and they said, nobody's going to understand this. And they had questions. And I realized, wow, this is over-the-top complex type of information. So I created a DVD where I gave a lecture. And it's one of my other DVDs then that's available, but is only sold with the book. And it's a lecture talking about the conditions and the situation with prime numbers. And I read a couple quotes from mathematicians at the time where they're stating that the prime numbers have baffled them. They are unable to find any order. And one mathematician states that they're equivalent to a bunch of random lottery numbers. That's the best thing he can say about organization of the prime numbers. Also, at the same time, interestingly enough, a mathematician named Terry Tao, who everybody honors as some kind of demigod, and his sidekick, Green, I forget what's his name, Ben Green, I think from the United Kingdom, came out with a paper that was published, and they claimed they actually won the field prize for this. They claimed that the prime numbers were random or semi-random, which means that there's really no order to them. There's no pattern that can be found. And if you look at my Calculate Primes book and then read the subsequent book, what you're going to find is that there is tremendous order in the prime numbers. In fact, they fit into categories of mathematical groups, and which there is closure, reciprocity, symmetry, the wave nature of the prime numbers, and all of these mathematical properties, which are very, very important mathematical properties in group theory. So the prime numbers actually contain all of these properties. And then there's patterns, I can't even go into it in this short lecture here, but very complex, but in another sense, very simple. And showing all the patterns. And after you get done reading that book, you'll understand that they should have rescinded the field prize to Terry Tao, because he created a paper which supposedly proved that the numbers of the prime numbers were random, and they are not random. So anyway, and then a little bit to put the frosting on the cake, and this is what made me realize that I always thought that it was the space science or geology world, etc., that was corrupt. I didn't think that the mathematical world was corrupt, but I sent my paper to Terry Tao to have published in one of the journals, and the end result was that he refused to have it published, and clearly, of all the people in the world, he should have understood what this paper did, and wrote a very terse response and did not send it to be refereed. So anyway, it was like him blocking my paper from being published, which would put his field prize and his paper basically out to pasture. Just another comment about prime numbers in general. Since the 1800s, the mid-1800s, there was the Gauss, and there were other people who were studying this problem. But along came the what they considered to be a major development by Riemann. And Riemann was a famous mathematician. He did a lot in calculus, in limits, in mathematical theory. And basically a fundamental paper talked about the complex plane and the what is known as the zeta function. And anyway, he made a proposal that all of the prime numbers are related to the 0 points on the 1/2 vertical line on the complex plane with the zeta function, or the Euler's golden key. There are a number of names for this formula. And computer simulations have shown that that's true up to a certain point, as far as it is possible to compute with computers. But that is not a proof. And so the whole issue is that Riemann would have never had to propose that if he had my work on the generator function being able to generate and calculate prime numbers in groups. And so just simply how it works, you take 0, you put it in the generator function, it generates the number 1. The number 1 and 0 you put into the generator function, and it generates the first few prime numbers. Then you take that group of prime numbers and you put it into the generator function, and it generates the next group of prime numbers. And so what's going on here is it's a method for directly calculating prime numbers in groups, not one at a time, but in groups. And so anyway, this is a huge breakthrough, because everybody was looking for something that was linear or along the number line, that one would follow the other and there was some kind of pattern that you would find, and there isn't any. But that's fine, but the generator function allows you to directly calculate the prime numbers. And you can do this very quickly and get up to very big prime numbers very quickly. And that is why there's been a lot of major hacking into big accounts, because the CIA, the NSA, will not allow good encryption software to be sold to the public. And they have blocked this at many points. I talked about back in the mid-1990s where the group called Heaven's Gate was publishing and selling encryption software and firewalls, which the CIA could not get into. And anyway, that's a whole other story that's related to the group being hired under the CIA, under the watchful eye, and funding from the U.S. government and the Justice Department to produce a software called Promise, which, by the way, was basically scuttled out of the United States and into the dark world of basically the dark internet and everything else. So, this is the problem. Once you get up into these levels with these people, they are corrupt. Corrupt beyond imagination. Okay. Then the other issue, I talk about this in my book, Breaking RSA Codes for Fun and Profit, where the major corporation selling encryption software to corporations also sold the back door into that software to the CIA and the NSA for a big chunk of money. And this came out just as a major international meeting was taking place where this company was promoting its software to sell. And it just gives you a level of the corruption when you get up to these levels. So when I released the book, Calculate Primes, it was, once again, on the Coast to Coast AM radio show, but I had pre-sold the book. Everybody else was still waiting for another book on the vein of my previous books. But I went to a foreign island to release this book because I knew the backlash would be so severe. Because it literally broke the encryption in the military, in military satellites, all branches of the military. And the next day, I started getting phone calls. And they were from people, engineers, who worked for Tier 1 science in the military, etc., asking me about the breaking of the RSA codes that had been used in encryption. It was in software, it was in hardware, it was in satellites, was in GPS systems, it was in everything, telecommunications. And that's why Michael Chertoff got up on the podium and said, all of our encryption is broken and is because of this book. But like I said, I had to release this because if I took it in private to these extremely corrupt people in the NSA and in the CIA, etc., I would probably be dead. I had to release it the way I did because I worked in that industry. I knew about it. I knew about the upper levels of corruption in the United States government, especially when it comes to computer security, etc. Okay, so that completes the first six books. The other books came later. I'll talk about those in a later episode, but I just also wanted to discuss the DVDs. So there are other products on my webpage. There's the two CD set. I've talked about this before, where I interview Warner Sizemore, who is Velikovsky's secretary. But it's 18 hours of lectures. It takes two CDs with MP3 lectures, and it's 18 hours. It's called The History of Planet X and Ancient Celestial Disasters. And so very important, that CD, set of CDs, two CDs, is extremely important information. You will learn a lot. I also have the aerial photographs. Now, this was an interesting phenomenon. I was in California, and there was, at the time, there was a big dust cloud, a huge dust cloud, because China was having a drought. So there was this immense dust cloud. It was up in the upper stratosphere. So I made arrangements to get on an airplane. And this was out of Mojave in California. And to fly up in when the sun was coming up early morning, and to take photographs up in the stratosphere, up as you get high enough in an airplane, even you will just see black sky above you. You will not see atmosphere. And I wanted to take pictures of this dust cloud. And so anyway, we're up at probably 45,000 feet elevation, and it's an absolutely pristine, clear morning. There was not a cloud in the sky from there all the way to Denver. So we made a flight all the way to Denver, and I'm taking pictures with my Nikon out of the airplane, and I took the picture of the entire American Southwest. Anyway, those photographs are on a CD that I sell. They're on my webpage, and all those photographs are available. And you can see the entire American Southwest all the way to Denver. And it was one of those days. Who knows how many days there are like that, where you have that stretch of, 1,000 miles with absolutely pristine, clear, dry sky with not a cloud in sight. So that's available on my website. Then there's the two DVD set, the historical record videos and remastered on DVD. Now, these go back. Now, remember that all of these were recorded on VHS, the old VHS tape standard. And then I had them remastered and put onto DVDs, digitized. And these are available on my webpage. But I just want to go through the titles here. I do a reenactment of the lecture I gave to 50 plasma physicists at Los Alamos National Laboratory. It was in May of 1986 when that lecture occurred. And so you'll see me as a much younger person. And that was in the time frame when I was gainfully employed as an engineer in the telecommunications industry. That was the company where I was working on IBM mainframe computer telecommunications computers. Okay, then number two on disc number one of this two DVD set, Astronomy for the 90s. And that was in 1991, professionally produced at the university level astronomy textbook study. So that's worth watching. And by the way, I still have all those textbooks. And if you looked at an astronomy textbook today, it wouldn't be that much difference. All of the same old garbage is still there. Then the third DVD recording on there is the 2002 Global Wings Conference, Denver, Colorado, Planet X Lecture. Once again, I'll just remind you that that's where Mark Hazelwood had a two-hour session. I happened to be in the area on a road trip about 4 hours away from Denver when it happened. And so anyway, Mark gave me half of his time slot there. and that's a recording of that. Now, I've talked about that. I'm not going to go into more detail. I've talked about that incident before in this year-long series of lectures. And then also accompanying that is the 2002 Global Wings Conference. There was a workshop where people were asking questions. And so that's interesting. You get to see me answering live questions. Also, okay, now we go to disc number two. This is, once again, historical remastered VHS tapes of me giving lectures in DVD in a DVD format. Number five, this is the first one on disc number two. This is the professionally produced lecture for cable TV that I gave. Remember the Tony Scarpelli story with Dan Golden? Tony won the Engineer of the Year Award, IEEE, and Dan Golden from NASA came to give the speech of accolades and the awards speech. And then he's talking to Tony, and Tony mentions my name to Dan Golden and says, "Have you ever heard of James McCanney?" And I'm not going to go into that again, but this is the video that was produced by Tony Scarpelli. And it was aired nationally. It was originally produced in a studio, cable studio in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And it eventually aired nationally. Then the next one is the 2003 UFO Congress invited lecture, Planet X and Historical Development, of J. McCanney, theoretical work. And so that's the 2003 UFO Congress in front of about 1,200 people. And then the next and last video in this list on two DVD discs set is the 2004 UFO Congress invited lecture, Electric Highways to the Stars. And that's where I released the Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn Connection book, and had a book signing. And I've talked about that, so I'm not going to repeat all of that. So this 2D DVD set is very important because it sets the historical record. And this is what you call a paper trail. If you look at all my work, my posters at American Geophysical Union meetings that go back to the 1980s, you see my work, my published papers at Cornell, 1979 to 81. You see peer-reviewed published papers in astrophysics journals. You see all of my work from that point on. There's a paper trail of everything that I've done that are in the public eye. And so this is what, when you find the quacks and the wannabes and the copycats and the plagiarists, they don't have that. They don't have a legitimate paper trail. They try and make it up. They try and pretend they have one, but they don't. But all of this gives you, and you see in these DVD records, you see me aging as you go through these. I mean, there's an 18-year span between 1986 and 2004 when these videos were taken. So you see me aging in these videos from a young man up until, you know, and then there's the paper trail of my books, the paper trail of my work on internet pages. All of this is recorded, and so it's constant. It's not like I took a year or two off. I've been at this weekly, daily, my radio show since the year 2000. I'm in my, right now, in the 22nd year of my radio show, another paper trail of exactly everything I've done. And you can go listen to all my radio shows. You can go listen to everything that happened. You can listen to my radio shows during the time back in the you can hear my radio shows with Art Bell in the 1990s. All of this is a paper trail. It is a paper trail that is very important to establish what I've done in this field. And then, of course, like I say, you've got the Johnny-come-latelys, wannabes, that come in and try and make up a story. And, of course, they just don't have a paper trail. A couple other things to mention here. And these came at different times, but I want to mention this now because it's a good time to mention these because I'm talking about my books and public record, etc. But I was invited onto Russian TV a number of times. So I've appeared on Russian primetime TV regarding the issues of space and space science, etc., in topics of Planet X and different topics about weather. One of the things was weather and weather manipulation that I talked about. And then there was a History Channel special, and you may see that now and then. They still rerun that. I have people come up to me all the time and say, I saw you on the History Channel the other day. And I'm like, oh, okay, they are still showing that. But there was a six-part episode or six-part program. It was called, I believe, Apocalypse Now. And I'm not sure if that was the complete name. But anyway, it was six sessions, and my specialty was the Hopi legends, of the Hopi Indians relative to the red and the blue Kachina, which represent comets. And so if you drive through the American Southwest through Hopi country, you cannot stop at a roadside rest or gas station or whatever without them having the red and the blue Kachina dolls. It's one of their major traditions. And so anyway, I represented the Hopi Indian legends relative to Planet X. And then also I was on Japanese television, and I got a call one day, and the Japanese producer called me up, and they were very interested in interviewing me because they had heard that I was the most famous person scientist in the United States and would have the correct information. And of course, what's interesting is the Japanese did not have this amazing, just blanket disinformation program coming out of the CIA. That what the United States, you couldn't turn a corner, you couldn't turn on a radio show hardly without getting disinformation about Planet X. So the Japanese did not have this, and so the producer himself came over, and this was a show like 60 Minutes. This is the Japanese version of 60 Minutes. And they came over, and we were going to do this in a studio. And I said, I got an idea. I have a studio in my building here. And so we went down to my studio, and they set up their camera works, and the producer could not speak English. So he had a producer out of New York, one of their affiliates, that came along with them, and she talked to me and then translated, and he asked all the questions. He had a whole big long list, and then we went out to supper afterwards. It was really a great event. And so they recorded this, and then they boiled it down to a single one-hour program to show to the Japanese people. And it aired in Japan, so here I am on national Japanese television. And so anyway, after it aired, I called up the producer in New York, the woman who had talked to me, because I certainly don't speak Japanese. I have a few talents, but that isn't one of them. But anyway, I asked her, I said, well, how did it go? And I said, how were the ratings? And she said, oh, well, everybody watches it. And if you say that, like in the United States, well, if it were the 60-minute program in the United States, there might be a football game, there might be a big game, there might be some other big event going on that might take precedence, and some people may not watch 60 Minutes that week, but would watch this other thing. And so I said, but how many people watch this? And she goes, everybody. And I'm like, yeah, but, you know, there's other shows on. She goes, no, in Japan, this show, everybody watches. Everybody stops whatever they're doing and watches this program. So she said, you were seen by literally everybody in Japan. And it was, now you can see this video. You cannot see the video that they put onto Japanese TV, but what you can see is I set up my own DVD camera and recorded the entire recording session with the producer. And you can see the whole thing taking place in my studio and from the viewpoint of my own DVD camera. And so that DVD is available on my webpage. It's called What the Japanese Want to Know About Planet X. And so there again, there is a timely piece. Now, how did the Japanese people know to contact me? It's just like the people from Russia. They came to the United States looking for me to be on their primetime television, because I was the person they trusted. I was the person that they came to. I was the go-to person, just like the people who had the Colburn gave it to people to hand to me because they knew I would interpret it correctly. And I was the only person allowed to distribute that information in the Western world. Apart from that, and then, of course, it was absconded with by CIA front people. And the one, if you look on the Amazon, they're selling something called the Colburn Bible. And this clown is claiming he wrote it. I mean, how absurd, how absolutely absurd. But there again, that is an effort to try and destroy that book, which is a masterpiece of information. But they wanted to get it into my hands because I could tell what it really meant. And so, and that is where the Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn Connection book came from. Part of it was because that was the release of that information of the Colburn to the Western world. Okay, so anyway, that's important to note there. And then also, I already talked about the Recalendar Sun-Star Clock, where the Surviving Planet X Passage pamphlet talks about building a calendar from and a clock from a pile of rocks. I made a much more sophisticated model of this, and something that most mariners and travelers and ancients would have loved to have had. It's an amazing design. It works any place on planet Earth, northern or southern hemisphere. It works with stars. It works with the sun. So you have a calendar and a clock for both stars and for the sun. And once you set it up, it's set up for all time at the location wherever you are. And it takes a few minutes to set it up, to adjust it, and set it up so it gives you the correct time. And a little story along with this. I was in South America and I typically carry one of these with me so that I have my own emergency recalendar Sunstar clock with me. So I'm at a place, and there was a guy who had a new watch. And he was very proud of this watch. It was like he would look at it every 5 minutes to see what time it was. And so I showed him this, and I said, "This is a clock, a sun clock." And he said, "Well, it can't be more accurate than his clock." And so I'm like, "No, we'll see." So I took a few minutes, and I set it up, and got it correctly positioned and everything like that. And then looked at the time, and I compared the time on my Recalendar Sunstar clock with his watch. And his watch was like 12 minutes different. And he said, "See, yours is off by 12 minutes. And I said, "No, well, look at the bottom right here. There's this table which converts sun time to watch time." And I did the conversion, and it came out exactly to his watch time. Because we are in an elliptical orbit. It's not a perfectly circular orbit. And because of that, the days vary. The Earth days from noon to noon vary in time. And so there's a chart which converts from watch time, which is consistent. Every day is churning out the same amount of time because it's a watch. It's a mechanical or electrical device. And the sun is changing. So there's a chart that gives you the difference between sun time and watch time. And when I used that chart that's on the Recalendar Sunstar clock, it's printed right on the same panel, I came out exactly with his watch time. And he was impressed. He was very, very impressed. That's all I can tell you. But anyway, it's an amazing device. And it gives all the information about the Earth's orbit in our solar system. And it sets it on a day in the year 2012, December 31st. December 21st. So that would be the winter solstice, Northern Hemisphere winter solstice of the year 2012, the year 2012. And that's very important because if in the future somebody ever discovers this thing and we've had a pole shift, they would not have any way of knowing our current solar system orbit unless there were something like this. So what I did is I invented something that never existed in history before because nobody ever knew that there was going to be a pole shift. Well, now I know that probably someday there will be a pole shift. So when I had this printed on this, it's called Dibond, it's almost indestructible. It's aluminum sheeting with a very, about an eighth inch core of fiber and an aluminum sheet on the back side. And when you print on this, the print, the mechanism, etc., is almost impossible to destroy. So there will be some of these recalendar Sunstar clocks in existence for thousands, ten thousands of years in the future. So if there's a demise of the human race due to a big Planet X type of comet event with Earth, and say the entire Earth population is exterminated, eliminated in this massive extinction event, then these calendars will be able to tell our history and put a timeline. And that's what Velikovsky was looking for. That's what he was looking for. And he had a very difficult time finding exactly when this event happened because there was no calendar that did what I'm doing with this. Set a timeline in relation to the Earth's orbital characteristics. So all of the Earth's parameters are on this chart, including the measurement of centimeters. And so how many centimeters in our orbit, etc., it's all there. And so if you know something about astronomy and orbits, you can look at this tablet and you will find all the information about our orbit there, including the direction of the North Pole. The precession of the North Pole is all included on that tablet. And where the North Star position was of the Earth's North Pole, and this is important, if there's a pole shift, that is going to be different. If we have a physical pole shift, that will be different. So something there again that nobody really imagined or thought about, but I came up with, and it's for sale on my webpage. Okay, just quickly going through some other things. I have a disc number 3, a DVD disc, Rewriting the Basic Structure of Science from the Subatomic World to Cosmology. This was done in 2007. It's available on my webpage. And then my poster sets, also available on the webpage. And then I have the university-level Astronomy Astrophysics Space Science course in a downloadable DVD, and then the 20-year anniversary of Hale-Bopp, Harrington Expedition, Planet X Update. And, of course, that was done in 2015, which was the precursor of one of my current books. One of my most recent books is called Planet X Update 2020, The Real History of Planet X, where I really go into the details of the Harrington discovery, and then my 3-poster collection set, all of these available on my webpage. But I'll be talking, and then I've got another 7 books that I'll be talking about in future lectures. But this somewhat wraps up the paper trail of the early 2000s. Once again, this set of lectures is brought to you commercial free. Go to my webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com, and use the coupon code JMCC for a 10% discount on all the products, and jmccsci.com. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.